Welcome back to Run the List, a medical education podcast in internal medicine. As a quick disclaimer, this podcast is made for educational and informational purposes only and should not be understood as medical advice under any circumstances. Before we get to the show, a quick word on the sponsors for today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by Open Evidence. Open Evidence is a really incredible resource for people in medicine. It's an AI-powered medical information platform that can help you answer clinical questions, provide high-quality literature, and so much more. You can ask questions like, what are the classic imaging findings for gout? Or, tell me about the landmark trials in lupus nephritis. They recently partnered with the New England Journal of Medicine, so they have access to their text, figures, and tables within Open Evidence. It's free and unlimited for healthcare professionals, so I highly encourage you to go check it out. Go to openevidence.com to learn more. Welcome back to Run the List. My name is Emily Gutowski, and I'm here with Dr. Noah Ripple, graduating chief fellow for Mount Sinai Hem-Onc Fellowship and incoming assistant professor at the Mount Sinai Tisch Cancer Institute. And today we're going to be talking about the topic of leukocytosis. Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Gutowski. I'm really excited to be here. I'm looking forward to talking all things leukocytosis.
Leukocytosis is something that comes up all the time, and there is a pretty big differential, which we're going to go through. So let's get into it. Today we have a 71-year-old female with a history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, COPD, and she's admitted overnight to the general medicine floor with generalized weakness and shortness of breath. Her vital signs show mild tachycardia at 103. She's afebrile, her blood pressure is normal, and her O2 sat is 96% on room air. Her labs start coming back and show a white blood cell count of 28,000, a hemoglobin of 11.8, platelet count of 310, and the overnight team empirically starts broad-spectrum antibiotics, looking at that white count, presuming an infection, while the rest of the workup is ongoing. So Dr. Ripple, what do you think about this case so far? Is the team right to jump straight to an infection, or what are some other potential causes of leukocytosis?
This is a really great case and one that we see so often. Maybe we can start off by setting the stage. So we know that a normal white blood cell count can range from 4,000 to 11,000 cells per microliter. And this is usually composed of about 40 to 60% neutrophils, 20 to 40% lymphocytes. And then monocytes tend to be less than 8%, eosinophils less than 5%. And basophils are quite rare, usually less than 1%. So this patient clearly has a leukocytosis, and it's also important to note her other labs. We know she has a mild anemia, and we see that her platelets are preserved. You know, before we jump to infection, which is always tempting, I try to take a step back and think about the patient as a whole. Good history and good exam findings can really go a long way in hematology, and we never want to get fooled by what can sometimes be a red herring. So what's in my differential? I would say first and foremost is COPD. It's important that we ask here what she's taking for that. Some patients keep emergency oral steroids on hand at home for COPD exacerbations. Could she have taken some prednisone earlier this week when she started feeling short of breath? A leukocytosis of 28,000 driven by just a short course of oral steroids would be a bit unusual and a bit of a hard sell. But is it impossible? No. Especially if there's a concurrent infection that's driving the COPD exacerbation in the first place. I would say that brings us to number two, infection, and that's absolutely on our list. Respiratory infection makes sense given the story, but we do need more context. What does her x-ray look like? Do we have any blood cultures, urinalysis? It is totally fair that the overnight team started antibiotics, but we should not stop our thinking there. We should also think about other causes. Does she have any risk factors for aspiration? We know that aspiration pneumonitis can also certainly drive the white count up from the inflammation alone. PE, or pulmonary embolism, is another important thought here. It can cause stress-related leukocytosis and can certainly also drive a COPD exacerbation. Could she be dehydrated? We know that dehydration can cause hemoconcentration, where our plasma volume decreases, making our counts appear relatively higher. But with that being said, in that case, we would expect all her cell lines to be proportionately elevated, which doesn't seem to quite fit here. We can also see leukocytosis as a simple physiologic stress response in acutely ill patients, but this would be another tough sell here, given that the white count is all the way up to 28,000. And then, of course, there's the never miss category. And acute leukemia is the big and scary one to keep in mind. It is less likely here, given that her hemoglobin and platelets are relatively preserved. And as far as we know, she has no blasts on her automated diff, but it's always in the back of my mind. There are also chronic bone marrow disorders to think about, things like myeloproliferative neoplasms or MPNs, but we'd need more data to make that determination. I really want to emphasize here, clinical context and the rest of the initial workup matter just as much as the white count itself. What does her CMP or comprehensive metabolic panel look like? What about the full automated differential? Does she have bands? Does she have blasts or anything else unexpected there? And the chest X-ray isn't just looking for pneumonia. I'm also looking for masses, effusions, cardiomegaly. All of these things can really affect how we interpret her white count. Of course, we need a thorough med rec. Steroids are not the only culprit when it comes to thinking about elevated white blood cell counts. Even beta agonists, things like albuterol, which she may well be on for her COPD, can cause leukocytosis. So all to say that every detail matters here.
So just to continue setting the stage for the topic of leukocytosis, can you talk a little bit about the actual mechanism, what goes on inside the body when the white count goes up, and does it depend on the underlying cause of the leukocytosis?
It certainly does depend on the underlying cause, and these are definitely important to know. With infection, it's pretty straightforward. Our body is fighting a pathogen, so the bone marrow ramps up neutrophil production and pushes them out into the periphery, into the blood. With malignancies, we know that there is an abnormal clone that's proliferating in an abnormal, uncontrolled way. So the cells themselves are the problem. But here's the one that really tends to trip people up. Sometimes the white count goes up without any new cells being made, and we call that demargination. At any given point, we know that roughly half of our neutrophils are freely circulating through the blood, but the other half are actually loosely stuck to the blood vessel walls. That's what we call our marginated pool of cells. When something causes those cells to unstick and flood back into the circulating pool of cells, our measured white count rises, even though the total number of neutrophils in our body hasn't actually changed. The classic example for this is steroids, and that's the one that always gets tested. The main way that steroids do this is by making neutrophils less adhesive so that they detach from the blood vessel walls. We definitely also see demargination with other conditions such as obesity. And the way that that works is that cytokines end up getting released from adipose or fat tissue, and they cause the same kind of neutrophil distribution or demargination. Stressors is another good cause, and that can be physical stressors, emotional stressors, and that can lead to neutrophilic predominant leukocytosis that, similarly to steroids, is also driven by demargination. And here, it's caused by a catecholamine surge. Finally, another cause to not forget is that the spleen actually sequesters a pretty meaningful chunk of our body's cells, not just white cells. And so when a patient is asplenic, we can definitely also see a bump in their white count.
Super interesting. Thank you for taking us through that. So in this case, it would be helpful to know what her most recent labs prior to this presentation looked like so we can get a sense of the acuity of this leukocytosis or the time course. Unfortunately, she hasn't been to a doctor in about 3 years. So this is the first piece of information we really have for a long time. If we did learn that her white blood cell count last month was around the same, how would that narrow our differential, and what if it was normal last month?
Yeah, this is such a great point and so important. I would say that chronicity is really huge. Acute leukocytosis develops over hours or days, and this is where we think about things like infections, steroids, bodily stressors, acute inflammations, and potentially also a brewing acute malignancy. Chronic is more along the course of weeks to months and even years, and that's a completely different ball game. And so if our patient's white count was the same a month ago, I would say that malignancy does move up my list. MPNs become a real consideration because we can see leukocytosis with any of them. Things like essential thrombocythemia, polycythemia vera, prefibrotic myelofibrosis, and even CML. PV is a bit less likely here, just given the fact that she has a low hemoglobin, but it's not impossible if something else like a nutritional deficiency is pulling the hemoglobin down. I would definitely be looking closely at the various elements of the differential on her CBC to make some of these differentiations. And then on the reactive side, chronic infections, things like osteomyelitis, TB, and abscesses should at least be entertained if there's anything concerning for these in her clinical context. And then there are also the chronic inflammatory conditions, things like IBD, rheumatoid arthritis, vasculitis. These should be on our differential, although they do seem somewhat less likely in an older patient who is not already known to have any of these diagnoses. And then, of course, chronic steroids. This is an important point. Steroid-induced neutrophilia typically presents with mature neutrophils without a left shift, and this can be really helpful in distinguishing it from infections. Smoking is another possible cause of chronic leukocytosis, but usually to a much milder degree, so it's less likely here. And asplenia is also relevant here as well. I would definitely also like to take a look at her blood smear under the microscope, and if the entire preliminary workup is negative, I think I would move pretty quickly to sending a peripheral blood flow cytometry and also potentially doing a bone marrow biopsy in this case.
So that's definitely getting us thinking about getting the hematology team involved when we see a number like this. Let's move on to the differential that comes along with the CBC, often referred to as the diff. I remember when I first started rotations, I kept hearing phrases like neutrophilic predominance or left shift, and I was very confused. I felt like everyone else knew some sort of lingo that I didn't know. So can you help us understand how the specific types of white blood cells being elevated narrows the differential and what these terms mean?
Yes, absolutely. Maybe we can start with a quick refresher. Our white blood cells fall into three big buckets. The first are granulocytes, and that's really the big one. Granulocytes are named for the granules in their cytoplasm, and these include our neutrophils, our basophils, and eosinophils. Then we have our lymphocytes, which are T cells, B cells, and natural killer cells, and these are a part of our adaptive immune system. And then finally, we have monocytes, and these are the precursors to macrophages and dendritic cells. And they're responsible for the body's immediate, nonspecific kind of first line defense. In terms of left shift, that just means that immature granulocytes are showing up in the peripheral blood. The fun fact for this term is that it actually comes from old lab counters that listed cell maturity from left to right. And so the more immature cells basically meant that there was a shift to the left on the lab counters. Now, when it comes to narrowing our differential by the types of white cells that we see, neutrophils tend to get us thinking about bacterial infections. That's a classic. But if we're seeing immature myeloid cells, things like neutrophil bands, myelocytes, metamyelocytes, you need to ask yourself if this is a reactive left shift from a bad infection, or could this be something else like CML? CML, or chronic myeloid leukemia, gives us myeloid cells at all stages of maturation. And another important diagnostic clue for CML would be if we see basophilia. Isolated basophilia as a reactive finding is extremely, extremely rare. And so if I see basophilia on the CBC differential, and especially if it's present with concurrent immature myeloid cells, that usually does put CML high up on my differential. Now, when it comes to lymphocytes, those get me thinking about viral infections. But in an older patient with a persistent lymphocytosis, CLL would definitely be high on my radar. Eosinophils get me thinking about parasitic infections, asthma, allergies, drug reactions like DRESS syndrome. And there are certainly also clonal blood cell disorders that involve eosinophils, things like chronic and acute eosinophilic leukemias. Just a couple more important points when it comes to this. The first is that we should never look at the white blood cells in isolation. For example, if we see nucleated red blood cells on our CBC, that's never a normal finding because it indicates the bone marrow is pushing out red blood cells before they've had a chance to mature. And so if we see a leukocytosis with immature myeloid cells with concurrent nucleated reds, we call that condition leukoerythroblastosis. And that basically means that we have to at least think about the possibility of a marrow-occupying process, such as myelofibrosis with marrow scarring, or potentially metastatic cancer that's infiltrating the bone. Finally, it's really important to remember that what we see on the automated differential never tends to be the full story, and it can actually mislead us. These machines can and do misclassify cells, and so when something doesn't add up, just call us, have us look at a blood smear. This is such an underutilized but incredible diagnostic tool.
Awesome. Thank you for that. So moving along in this case, our infectious workup thus far has actually been negative. Her chest x-ray comes back clear, her UA and CMP are normal, and her cultures have all come back negative. So what's next? What other labs can we obtain that might help us here?
Yeah, so I think first thing I would do is I would actually circle back to the patient's history. Is there anything that could be suggestive of autoimmune disease? Does she have any GI symptoms that could point potentially to undiagnosed inflammatory bowel disease? Does she have any constitutional symptoms? Things like fevers, night sweats, weight loss, anything that would hint at a potential malignancy. I would also specifically ask about abdominal discomfort, early satiety, if she has any itching, any brain fogginess. These are MPN-associated symptoms that patients don't always necessarily volunteer unless we explicitly ask about them. In terms of labs, a peripheral blood smear is really a must, and if absolutely nothing comes back positive on our initial workup, I would also say that peripheral blood flow cytometry would be important here as well, and that could potentially be followed by a bone marrow biopsy with cytogenetics and molecular studies as one of our next steps.
Okay, excellent. Moving on to day two of our patient's hospitalization, the white blood cell count continues to rise. It's climbed from 28,000 the first day to 39,000 the next day, and then by that afternoon, 45,000. So we're starting to get a little bit worried. The next day, it's 65,000. We've consulted hematology at this point for assistance, but we're also starting to worry not only about the underlying reason for the leukocytosis, but the actual effect of such profound leukocytosis on the body. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Absolutely. This is such a good question. So with the rapidly rising white count like this, malignancy now has to be high on our differential. We do rarely see white counts this high with severe infections, but those patients tend to be quite more ill. Workup-wise, this is a situation where we definitely would move on the faster side. After we again carefully review the automated differential, I would definitely obtain another peripheral blood smear at this point and manually review it again. Things can change, and maybe this patient did have a brewing acute leukemia, and we may suddenly see the appearance of blasts on the blood smear that may have not been there before. This is also when we need to make sure that we have things like tumor lysis markers, uric acid, calcium, phosphorus, potassium, in case this really is a new cancer. Also really important here would be coagulation studies and fibrinogen so that we can rule out DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulation. If this was present, this would raise my concern for APML, or acute promyelocytic leukemia. And I would most likely move ahead at this point with an urgent bone marrow biopsy. Now, in terms of getting to the effect on the body of the elevated white blood cells, this would totally depend on what types of white blood cells are driving this count. Blasts are really the scary ones. And that's because they're large, they're sticky, and they basically sludge up our small blood vessels. That's what we call leukostasis. When these large, sticky cells block blood vessels and hurt our various organs as a result. And some big signs and symptoms to keep in mind are dyspnea, sometimes hypoxia with infiltrates on imaging, and also neurologic symptoms of any kind. And these can range all the way from mild confusion to full-blown strokes. And in AML, or acute myeloid leukemia, we get concerned for leukostasis when the white blood cell count is higher than about 100,000 cells, which is called hyperleukocytosis. And in some subsets of AML, we could also see leukostasis with as few as 50,000 white blood cells. On the other hand, we have patients with conditions such as CLL or chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and these patients can sit with white blood cell counts that are often in the many hundreds of thousands, composed of all mature lymphocytes, and these patients feel completely fine. They may not even meet criteria for treatment, which is crazy, right? We get called for these patients all the time because their numbers look terrifying, and our answer is usually, don't worry about it. They're small mature lymphocytes, and they don't tend to cause leukostasis. Now, in terms of how we treat leukostasis, we tend to emergently go ahead with cytoreduction to get rid of the blasts in our blood. Hydroxyurea tends to be our drug of choice in the acute setting, and that's because it's nonspecific, it works within hours, and it's oral. So until we have our diagnosis, it's effective, and then afterwards we can initiate chemotherapy. In terms of other things like leukapheresis, the data just doesn't show a consistent survival benefit over hydroxyurea alone. It's much more resource intensive, and it requires patients who already tend to be quite sick and prone to infections and to bleeding to have large bore access placed. And so when it comes to leukapheresis, we tend to really reserve this for symptomatic patients whose leukostasis is not responding to any other measures.
Thank you for explaining that. I know this is a topic that might not come up as often as just regular leukocytosis, but when we get to these more advanced numbers, these are absolutely factors that we need to consider. So let's take a step back and pivot to a slightly different version of this case. Suppose the same patient had a mildly elevated white blood cell count for 10 plus years, hovering around 12.5 to 14, let's say. And they've undergone a workup for concerning underlying causes, but that's really been unrevealing. What could be going on with a mild leukocytosis that's chronic?
So now we know that our patient has a mild leukocytosis that's been rock solid stable for over a decade. I'm super reassured by that. No emergent blood disorder stays stable and without associated symptoms that long without treatment. And so right off the bat, we can be pretty sure that this isn't an acute leukemia. And so we shift our thinking toward chronic causes. Could this still be a chronic inflammatory condition or potentially smoldering infection? Sure. But honestly, at this low level leukocytosis and for this duration, I'm also thinking about lifestyle and comorbidity-driven causes, things like obesity, obstructive sleep apnea or OSA, smoking, and even medications. Of course, chronic malignancies are still possible. Things like MPNs, CML, CLL can all simmer for years with stable counts. And sometimes this low-level leukocytosis is really just where the patient lives. Some people run at a white count of 12 or 13, and that's just their normal. What I'd really want to look at here is the white cell differential. Are there any subtle abnormalities that are hiding there? And what have the hemoglobin and platelets been doing over the same period? These trends can actually be incredibly revealing. And of course, history and exam are still key. We need to check for lymphadenopathy, splenomegaly, and ask about those constitutional symptoms. If any of those red flags are present, they warrant further workup, even if our patient has had a stable count for this long.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I know I've had many patients who have had these chronic low-level leukocytoses, and it's always helpful to have a hematology referral just to make sure we're not missing anything. But as you said, some people just live in a higher reference range, and we have to remember that these reference ranges are established based on most people's normal, but that does not include everyone. As we are wrapping up this topic, and this has been a wonderful discussion of leukocytosis, do you have any other clinical pearls or take-home points that you want to leave us with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think an important pearl that we hadn't touched on yet is that when we evaluate patients' white blood cell differential in a patient with leukocytosis, we should never be looking at the percentage of white blood cell types. It's really the absolute counts that matter, not their relative percentages. And this comes up all the time and is such an important takeaway point and a really common pitfall.
That's a very good point. And in my rheumatology world, we often look at, on the other end, leukopenia, and sometimes the percentage can be low, but the absolute number can be normal or vice versa. And always good to take into account the absolute, you know, lymphocyte or neutrophil count. So the same goes for the other end of the spectrum as well. And any final take-home points before we wrap up here?
This has been such a good discussion. And I think a couple important take-home points would be good history, good exam, always. I would also say never look at one CBC in isolation, just like with any other labs. Trends really do matter. And also, always try to order a differential with your CBCs. The total white count just isn't informative enough, and we need to know what the breakdown is. The only exception for this might be for a patient undergoing routine pre-op screening in an otherwise healthy patient. But if you're trying to figure something out, you do need the differential. And lastly, I would say don't get stuck on red herrings. This isn't just for leukocytosis or even just for heme. Leukocytosis doesn't always mean an infection, and a normal white count doesn't always rule it out either. So I would say think critically, look at the whole picture, and try to not let just one number drive your decision making.
Perfect. This has been a wonderful discussion. I think we can all feel much more confident handling patients with elevated white counts due to your expertise. So thank you so much, Noah, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily. It was such a pleasure.